It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, dystopian fiction like The Hunger Games was once the thing for teens, but our guest says that's changing with something even more depressing taking its place. First, a new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism finds that Wisconsin taxpayers have missed out on millions of dollars in settlements after lawmakers repealed the False Claims Act in the 2015 to 2017 state budget. That law provided incentives for whistleblowers to come forward with reports of fraud. It had been one of the most effective tools to find Medicaid fraud in particular, according to interviews and public records. Dee Hall is the managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She joins us now for details on this new report. Dee, welcome back.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, give us the basics. What is, or I guess was, the False Claims Act in Wisconsin?
The State False Claims Act allowed whistleblowers, or people usually generally within companies, to report and to prosecute as private plaintiffs fraud when they came across it in the Medicaid program specifically. It was modeled after a federal law. The federal law still exists, and it was part of a Deficit Reduction Act quite a few years ago by the federal government to try to incentivize states to really crack down on Medicaid because it's a state and federal program.
And what would this fraud look like? A pharmaceutical company overcharging, that kind of thing?
That's a classic kind of fraud that we're talking about. This is mostly corporate fraud. This is instances where the corporations allegedly overbilled the state Medicaid program.
And this happened quite a bit, it looks like.
There have been millions and millions of dollars worth of fraud that has been uncovered over the years by both whistleblowers and by other methods.
But you say in the report, whistleblowers were often the key method that started the road to finding out this kind of fraud.
Right. So according to the U.S. Department of Justice, about 88% of the claims that were filed, of the civil lawsuits that were filed that allege medical fraud, Medicare, Medicaid fraud, were actually filed by whistleblowers and their attorneys.
Now, as we mentioned, this False Claims Act went away in the budget just a couple of years ago, but it had been kind of fading out over time for a couple of years before that. Can you talk us through how we stopped using this False Claims Act, in effect?
Well, there were some messages sent from the federal government to the state of Wisconsin beginning in 2011, telling the state you need to update your False Claims Act in these particular ways so you can continue to qualify for this extra bonus, this 10% bonus payment. So what would happen was the state would get more than its share, 10% more than its share of the money back when fraud was detected, but only if they had a qualifying False Claims Act. And the state declined to update the act. And then in 2015, the 2015-17 budget, they eliminated the law altogether.
And we're the only state, as I understand it, to have had a False Claims Act like this and to have repealed it.
That's our understanding from the National Whistleblower Center.
And how much money did the state miss out on because of this?
Well, we asked them several times to try to estimate that for us. They weren't interested in doing that. So we asked a group called Taxpayers Against Fraud, and they're experts in these type of whistleblower lawsuits. And they, along with our own calculations, estimated about $11 million since the state refused to strengthen and then overturned the law.
Now, we've got law enforcement and an attorney general's office in the state. Isn't that enough to watch out for this kind of fraud?
Well, that's what the big business group said, and they were really pushing for us to get rid of our State False Claims Act. They also were very active at a point where there were some proposals to expand it beyond the Medicaid program to other programs that use private contractors, and that was halted. But yes, that is the argument that is made, that this is a better way to do it, is rely on the regular law enforcement mechanisms to identify this fraud and to prosecute it.
And it sounds like another argument from business groups in particular was this is just a plaintiff's attorney enrichment sort of program. I can make money by filing this fraud claim, but my lawyer makes a lot of money. It doesn't really benefit the state.
Right. So that was the argument. They were derisively called, these whistleblowers and their attorneys were derisively called bounty hunters. And there was this sense among the business groups that individuals should not profit. Individuals and their attorneys who identify this waste and fraud should not profit. But at the way these suits work, the prosecutor or the whistleblower and his or her attorney actually take the risk by launching the suit themselves, and then the state has the opportunity to join in.
We're talking to Dee Hall from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism about A fraud program in Wisconsin that was repealed a couple years back, the False Claims Act, aimed at trying to track down Medicaid fraud. Report finds that the state has missed out now on millions of dollars since then. So is it likely, is it possible that now this kind of Medicaid fraud is going on and not being detected because there isn't this much incentive for a whistleblower, say, as you said, an employee or former employee at a company to report this?
Well, it's possible. Again, the state said it was too early to say whether there's been any lack of incentive of whistleblowers to come forward. I will say, though, that the former attorney general, as a citizen, filed a lawsuit against a handful of pharmaceutical companies claiming that they were overcharging the state. And the activity went back prior to the repeal of the False Claims Act, but a Dane County judge said, no, the state has repealed the False Claims Act. You can't bring this action. And so she and her attorney are claiming that the state could lose out on tens of millions of dollars if they decline to join in the case, which they have so far done.
That's former Attorney General Peg Lautenschlager. Has the current Attorney General's office participated in this case at all?
No, they've declined to participate in it. They've called the claims stale and said that they have problems with the merits of the case, but the attorney in the case is also the former deputy attorney general of the state of Wisconsin, Daniel Bach, and he indicated that, in fact, this suit is almost identical to other suits that have been brought both by Lautenschlager when she was attorney general and settlements that have been signed by the current attorney general, Brad Schimmel himself.
Now, Wisconsin has moved away from this False Claims Act. What's the trend in other states around the country?
Well, we don't know of any others that have moved away from it. There was an effort that was successful to block West Virginia from enacting a False Claims Act. So that's the only other trend we know of. It was a nationwide push that went on a couple of years ago, and in Wisconsin it was successful.
So if I am working at one of these companies, I'll say a pharmaceutical company or what other kind of companies, I should say, are distributors or medical offices part of this?
Medical equipment suppliers, insurance companies, and anybody who might be able to file a claim with the Medicaid program that would enrich them and unjustly. And so if you're a whistleblower, you can still report that to the Inspector General of the Department of Health Services. You could still call the State Department of Justice, but you would not have the incentive to hire a lawyer and try to bring an action on your own because you won't get repaid for that effort.
Do we know how often that happens? I know you said that the Attorney General's office or the state says we don't know how the repeal of that law has affected the numbers, but do we know in general how many people are doing this at any given year?
No, it varies year to year, and many of the cases for which Wisconsin is still continuing to get settlements, these are federal cases that involve multiple states, and they may have started as a whistleblower claim under the Federal False Claims Act. So it's a little too early to tell. It's sort of like proving a negative. We don't know what fraud is out there that we don't know about that people have decided not to bring forward because they don't have the incentive. So it's hard to say, but we can say that of the cases that were brought forward, the state has lost some money because they don't get that extra 10% bonus anymore.
And you wrote that a spokesman for the governor said, well, we're not doing that, or didn't comment on that, but said we're doing a lot of good stuff when it comes to fraud and waste in the state.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the state has, and this is part of, I should mention back up, this is part of a series of stories that we're doing called Broken Whistle, and it was reported primarily by my investigative reporting class here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Journalism, and So the governor's office has said, look, we're still prosecuting Medicaid fraud. There's no doubt that that's going on. But these types of cases are, according to the repeal and then now a judge's decision, not allowed anymore in the state.
Is anybody talking about wanting to bring back this False Claims Act in Wisconsin?
I have not heard that currently. I'll be interested to see whether this prompts anybody to take a look at it. The honest truth is it would be very difficult, given the people who oppose the False Claims Act, for lawmakers to bring it forward.
We'll leave it there for now. Dee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dee Hall, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She joined us for the details on a new report that shows Wisconsin taxpayers have missed out on millions of dollars in settlements since lawmakers repealed the False Claims Act. You can find a link to that report at WPR.org. Coming up, dystopian stories were once all the rage in young adult fiction. Think Hunger Games. But our guest says that's changing. We'll find out why it's on the decline and what's replacing it. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. In the 2000s, dystopian fiction for teens was all the rage. Think of The Hunger Games, Divergent, or The Uglies. They all take place in a world of destruction and authoritarianism where only a brave few try to make a better world. After President Trump was elected, classic dystopian books like 1984 saw a spike in sales, and Hulu turned The Handmaid's Tale into an award-winning series. But the trend went in a different direction for young adult pop culture. Our next guest writes that the new popular genre for young adults often involves stories of teen suicide, and it could even be replacing the hugely popular dystopian genre. Here to tell us why, Constance Grady. She's a culture writer for Vox. Constance, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into the details of your piece, why is it important for us to look at and think about young adult pop culture as maybe a lens into what's going on in our country?
Well, one thing that we always say among culture critics is that pop culture is America's subconscious. You know, it's where we project all of our fantasies and anxieties and play them out in ways that our brains can deal with. So pop culture aimed for teenagers is sort of the purest distillation of that impulse because it is simultaneously didactic and escapist. It's there to provide moral lessons to the youth, but it's also there to be an escape for the rest of the population. You know, the way an adult person will go home and say, oh, I'm going to watch an episode of that trashy teen show Riverdale tonight to relax. So pop culture that we make for teenagers will tell us both how we think that we should think about an issue, because we'll be passing that along to the teenagers in a didactic lesson, and also how we actually think about it, because that'll be the fun subtext that the adults are watching for.
And let's dig into this trend you're spotting here, a move from dystopias in young adult pop culture to stories related to suicide. Spell out what you're seeing, what we used to have, what we're seeing more of now.
Absolutely. So about 5 or 10 years ago, the biggest trend in teen pop culture was the YA dystopia that you get with something like The Hunger Games or the Divergent franchise. It was a wave that began shortly after 9/11 and continued on through the Occupy era and the Wall Street crash. It was sort of designed to deal with those particular fears and worries about terrorism, about income inequality, about climate change. And that's sort of been trickling away over the past few years. There was a kind of sense among a lot of people I spoke to that we'd be getting a resurgence of that boom after the 2016 election. But so far, we haven't been seeing that. The big stories that are really taking up space in teen pop culture right now tend to be stories like 13 Reasons Why, which is based on a 2007 YA novel and is about a 17-year-old girl who dies by suicide. This is not to say that there is some sort of boom in the publishing industry right now, that lots and lots of YA novels about suicide are being published, but it is to say that the stories that already exist about suicide are taking up a disproportionate amount of space in the cultural conversation.
And you're right, it's not just 13 Reasons Why. You see other examples in books, TV, even music.
Exactly. There's a big pop song that went double platinum this year, and the title is actually the number of the suicide hotline. It's called 1-800-273-8255. And it's about, one of the recurring lines is, can anyone relate, does anyone feel this way about the problem of suicidal ideation among teenagers?
So why do you think this change is happening from dystopias in young adult pop culture to suicide being a big theme?
Well, teen pop culture has been interested in the idea of self-destruction for a while, clearly. But I think the big difference that you see moving from a dystopian self-destructive fantasy to a suicidal self-destructive fantasy is that, first of all, the dystopia is social destruction, right? It's not any one individual's fault. It's the fault of this system that we've set up. But in the suicide fantasy, the self-destruction is very personal, and it's entirely dependent on this one individual. It's also a much more nihilistic fantasy in that it's final, part of the dystopian fantasy was that there was a plucky young, usually teenage girl who is able to save the day at the end and get the world back on course to become a better world. There was this sort of uplifting note at the end. But in the suicide fantasy, the ending is final. It's as if we can't imagine the plucky young girl saving the world anymore, so instead we're imagining the plucky young girl killing herself.
Yeah, it's weird to think about, Constance, that a lot of these dystopian novels were uplifting and optimistic. It's a horrible world, but somebody can do something. Yeah, exactly. So why are we losing that optimism then?
I think we've been seeing these stories really take hold over the course of the 2016 election. Obviously, they were all either completed or well into production by the time that Donald Trump won the election. But the campaign season took a very, very long time, multiple years. And through the course of that whole thing, a lot of these very dark political forces started to rise up and become more and more entrenched in political discourse. You know, the white supremacists of the self-described alt-right started moving up. There was a lot of very blatant misogyny. And there was a general sense that became more and more entrenched in American pop culture that we were on some sort of a self-destruct mission. And I think that teen culture picked up on that and reacted to it.
We're talking to Constance Grady, staff writer at Vox, about a new piece she's written looking at what she sees as a shift from young adult dystopia in popular culture to suicide in young adult pop culture. And Constance, should we be worried about portrayals of suicide and stuff that's being read and watched by teens? Is there a potentially destructive side there?
Well, certainly experts have studied suicidal contagion, and there's data that suggests that it can lead to copycat deaths. And certainly after 13 Reasons Why was released on Netflix this summer, internet searches on how to commit suicide seem to have spiked following its release. So it certainly is possible to be very, very destructive with this story and with this fantasy, even when you have the best of intentions. I'm certain that everyone involved in 13 Reasons Why meant to be making a story that would prevent people from trying to hurt themselves, even if they may have unintentionally had the opposite effect. On the plus side, there are lots of resources out there explaining how to avoid suicidal contagion and how to tell a story about this issue that does not lead to copycat deaths. And certainly those are out there, and definitely creators should take advantage of that information.
So if young adults in particular are looking at novels and shows and whatever that tackle suicide, do we read it as meaning they are demoralized, they are kind of giving up, they're despondent, or is it an opportunity to take the dark stuff, the negative stuff that's out there, wallow in it in this safe space, and then maybe in their daily lives that isn't so powerful anymore?
I think it can work both ways. I think for a lot of people, this is a sort of cathartic fantasy that works sort of the way a dream does, to work out some negative emotions that you might have and give yourself a space to get over it without bringing it into your daily life. And that seems to be the way it works for a lot of people. It's also the case that people who already struggle with suicidal ideation may react differently to these stories and may find themselves seeing suicide as more attractive after reading with them, and they should talk to a loved one or a counselor and seek help to deal with that.
And then back into the realm of pop culture, do you see counter trends that could rise to the surface? I'm thinking of Wonder Woman, a big movie, very successful, watched by, I assume, a lot of young adults along with everybody else. A young woman seeing a tragic attack, big loss in her homeland, and going out, and like the young adult dystopian heroines you talked about, going out and fighting it head on.
Absolutely. I think there is a strong trend towards more optimistic storytelling in a lot of the pop culture that we make mostly for adults. you know, the superhero movies have spent a long time being very dark and gritty and all gray and blue tones. And with the success of Wonder Woman, they seem to be reformulating them to be more brightly colored and joyous. In sitcoms, you're seeing a move prestige dramas as well. You're seeing a move away from the anti-hero stories of, you know, the Don Drapers and the Walter Whites, and moving towards more stories about, you know, basically good people who want to do good things. I think there's a real craving for that on the level of the pop culture that we're making for adults. I'm not seeing as much sort of cheerful and optimistic storytelling in the pop culture that we make for teenagers right now, but that certainly may change over time.
If a young adult listener is listening, thinking, yeah, I am reading these novels related to suicide or watching things, and I'd like a break now. Would you have a prescription, Constance, that they could mix up their reading habit a bit with?
There are a lot of great novels out now about mental health that are not quite as nihilistic as something like 13 Reasons Why. I think John Green's Turtles All the Way Down is a good example of a main character who's struggling with anxiety disorders and obsessive compulsive disorder. And it's a very, very realistic story. John Green himself has struggled with anxiety disorders, and it's based closely on his life. But the main character is able to find constructive ways of dealing with her disorder and having a good and full life, even as she works with it.
Sounds like a great start. Constance, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Constance Grady is a culture writer at Vox. She joined us to talk about the emerging popularity of teen suicide stories in young adult fiction, and she told us why it might be replacing the once popular young adult dystopian genre. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. First, it seems like we all know that one person, you know, the type, the one who will do and say anything to get ahead, even if it means kissing the boots of the boss. Like it or not, there are sycophants, better known as suck-ups, all around us. And while many of us like to grumble about it, it's a behavior that's been around for a long time. Our next guest wanted to take a closer look at this, why we do it, why it angers us, and why it maybe works sometimes. In a new book, he shares what he found, as well as plenty of examples of sucking up throughout human history. Mark Parker joins us now. He's a professor of English at James Madison University and co-author with Deborah Parker of the new book, Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by having you give us a good definition, a working definition of sycophancy. What do we mean by that?
It's using deceptive practices to get something out of someone else by sort of making them feel better about themselves or making them feel about the world in ways that aren't particularly true.
Well, you're clearly a person of taste and refinement, Mark, so I'm sure you're going to give us a good interview today. No, but seriously, what is it that got you and your co-author interested in this topic? It's a little off the beaten path.
It sure is. We started working on it about 3 years ago, and we were at a dinner party, and people started talking about people they knew around them who were sucking up. And the stories are really interesting, and as people tend to do, one sort of led to another, and everyone tried to outvie each other with their greatest and most unbelievable sycophant. And after a while, we were all feeling a little bit, sort of amused and also appalled at the same time. But afterwards, my wife and I were talking about it, and we thought we really ought to think a little bit about such an interesting social phenomenon, because it's not at all obvious exactly why it works so well, and it's also not obvious how pervasive it is.
One thing it is not, Mark, as I learned from your book, is new. This is going back. People have been complaining about flatterers for thousands of years. Can you talk about some of the earliest examples of people complaining about this?
Well, it goes back, the first use of the word is from a Greek play by called Wealth, in which there's a character called Sycophantes, which is basically where the word comes from, sycophant. And that's a character who basically is kind of like an opportunistic ambulance chaser who finds sort of people who are breaking the law and turns them in. And it's a sort of an odd sort of beginning for the word, but it does get some of the deception and perhaps the malice. It brings that out about the term.
And this we can find in a lot of different environments, the corporation, politics, everywhere. There's not really a place where there isn't some example of this, is there?
No, it seems to be all places and all times. Our book didn't really deal across cultures. There was plenty within our own, within the sort of European and English-speaking cultures to look at. But it does seem to be pretty pervasive.
And another thing that seems to be common is people hope that the sycophant, the flatterer, gets what's coming to them. Even Dante in the Inferno, the flatterers end up in a particularly bad place in the afterlife, right?
Yeah, that was a very interesting place to start to think about flattery, because whenever my wife teaches Italian, and she does Dante very often, and whenever she teaches it or whenever I taught that book, our students are always stunned that flatterers are actually lower in hell than murderers and some tyrants, and it just seems counterintuitive to them. But Dante is very clear about why he puts them lower down than someone who takes someone's life. He thinks that it's a sin against community that makes it impossible to have a working community, and so he considers fraud like this to be much worse than murder. Fraud never has an end. It has a kind of an effect on the cultural fabric, that is worse, he thinks, in some terms, than just a simple murder.
I don't know if you're on the same page as Dante, but can you talk about the damage that you see sycophancy sucking up doing in modern life?
Well, again and again, in modern life, I think one of the differences is people used to call this out, and people used to say very clearly that this was a moral failure. I think that people tend to view it now as somewhat more transactional. It's something that they begin, they enter into, they do it for a purpose, they think, a limited purpose, and then they think that they exit from it pretty free from any kind of opprobrium or any kind of real ethical lapse. I think there's a certain commodification, I think, that's come to sucking up now.
We're talking to Mark Parker. He's co-author of the new book, Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. And Mark, you mentioned the origin of the word sycophant. And then there are phrases like sucking up, lickspittle, brown noser. They're all kind of gross and kind of biological. What's up with that?
It has always been associated. The act of sycophancy has almost always been associated with excrement. It's sort of there are many stories which turn on this kind of excremental vision, and I think that gets the kind of a couple of essential senses across from the older and traditional way of thinking about sycophancy. There's a sense in which it's something that sticks. You don't simply walk away from it sort of clean. That there's a kind of a smearing that you're doing to this yourself as well as to the world.
And you give multiple examples from Europe to I think an ancient Chinese emperor, where a person will. There will be a person in power, they pass gas, or they moon somebody, and then the sycophant, their follower, basically waxes rhapsodic and tells glorious verses about the wonder of the anatomy or smell in question.
That's right. It's sort of some of these stories are clearly maybe more or less reliable, but they do turn on this idea that there's something spectacular about the act when people talk about it, and then it's easily turned into a kind of anecdote which turns on excrement and turns on abasement. It's sort of a kind of a can you believe this story, at least when people tell it over and over again.
And Mark, I assume everybody thinks we're smart enough to know if somebody's doing this to us, flattering us to get their way. We're all so smart, we're going to spot that. Obviously not, though, right? Because this works?
It does work. One of the things that I was perhaps, I mentioned that we're amused and appalled by this when we see examples of it, but one of the things that I was appalled by when we were preparing this book was we looked through some of the literature from psychology about it, and it's pretty clear. They concur that it works. There's a sense in which we're very vulnerable to this kind of activity, and we tend to overlook it. There's a kind of a need that people have, and people are great enablers of sycophants. That's the other half of this equation. It's not just the sycophant, it's also the person who draws it out and surrounds themselves with sycophants that is really at fault here. It works.
For someone in a position of power, and that seems to be a key element in this, but say you're a boss and you're thinking, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be fooled by somebody just flattering me just to get what they want. Are there signs? Are there ways we can try to spot this?
Interestingly enough, Plutarch, the sort of Roman Greek writer from many centuries ago, has a wonderful little essay about how to tell a flatterer from a friend. And those are the two terms that really loom large here. A friend is someone who wants good things for you and who wants you also to be a good person and who may say unpleasant things to you. A flatterer is someone who won't do either, who doesn't wish you any good and will certainly not try to turn you towards good things. What Plutarch sort of suggests is that someone who is trying to test whether someone's a flatterer or a friend is to change one's mind and see if the flatterer will always go along, and to see if, just to be very mindful, and to see if the flatterer actually will suggest that they cut corners morally or ethically or do things that are beneath them. There are some ways to figure this out. But one of the more difficult things about sycophancy and flattery generally is it turns on intention. The same act almost can, well, there are extremes, of course, that don't sort of admit of any sort of doubt, but the same act sometimes can be seen from as flattery or as just friendship and well-wishing.
And it seems like it'll be pretty basic to human psychology. If somebody's saying nice things about me, I'll probably want to hear that and not question the motivation behind it, because I like hearing nice things about me.
Is. And I think one of the reasons there are so many anecdotes and they're so well worked up and the sort of tradition of thinking about flattery is so well developed is that it is such a danger, and it can sort of slip by people before they actually know what's happening.
We're talking right now with Mark Parker. He's co-author of the new book, Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. We're looking at the behavior often known as sucking up, why we do it, why we can't stand it when other people do it, and whether or not it works. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this maybe at your workplace? What's the most egregious example of sucking up that you've seen? Have you, be honest, done it yourself? If you're a boss, how do you sort it out, whether people are doing that to you? Does it work? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Mark Parker. He's a professor of English at James Madison University, and he's co-author of the new book, Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this kind of sycophantic behavior, brown-nosing, people call it, play out at your workplace or elsewhere in your life, in the American public in general? Do you think that when people do this, they get what they want? Is it possible to spot this? Have you fallen prey to it if you've been on the other end of this? And what questions do you have about it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Mark, in researching and writing this book, are you spotting sycophancy everywhere you look, more so now that you've got your radar turned on?
Well, I have to say a lot of times that when I see things, I hang fire a bit because it's so easy to mistake it, and it's so hard to sort of put your finger on it sometimes. You really have to sort of not jump to a conclusion about one thing or another unless it's really, really obvious.
Let's go to our callers now. Gail is on the line in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Oh, hi. Hi. Oh, this takes me way back to my corporate days, too. We had so many and such a variety of them. But my question is, we had a schmoozer. He was so good at it. And the schmoozer isn't necessarily a suck-up, but he sure gets his way a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So where would you categorize the schmoozer?
The schmoozer versus the suck-up. Gail, thanks. What do you think, Mark?
I would put that in there with this larger sort of spectrum of ingratiation, because that's certainly, you're making people feel better about themselves. And if you're doing it, again, to deceive, that's a different thing. If you're making people feel better about themselves because you like them and are polite, that's one thing. But if you're really using it as a means to an end, I think you've crossed a line. And that's what's very difficult about this behavior, is that it can be very difficult to see what someone's intention is with a given behavior.
If I'm doing it, do I know what my intention is? Am I conscious that I'm intentionally manipulating people, or is this just kind of how I am?
What the research in psychology shows pretty clearly, and certainly a lot of literary texts, is that people do not understand it when they're doing it, and they tend to basically build up a kind of target figure, a person whom they're sucking up to, who is far better than the one that they see in real life. They kind of imagine a better person, and that justifies this humiliating behavior to themselves.
And how do I know if I'm, you know, just in a meeting and wanting to be part of the team? Yeah, boss, it's a good idea. I don't know. I haven't really thought about it, but sure, why not?
I think that is always a kind of a gray area. I think you'd go back to Plutarch and say, you think about intent, but of course you can't really know that. But you also think about just pervasiveness. Is it your habitual response, or is there really some thought behind it? I think one of the things that I came away with after doing this kind of research was that it really is worth slowing down and being a little more mindful about your activities within a culture. I think all of us want in society to be polite and to be kind and to be helpful. And all of us want other things with our careers. And we have to be very careful not to mix those two very different sort of goals.
Gail, thanks for calling in. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jerry is on the line in Glendale. Jerry, hi. Oh,
hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to point out that the term sucking up can be used in a very disparaging and manipulative way. I was in a position for a couple of years. A new director was hired. There was a lot of angst about the new director. People didn't want to go along with the policies. I took a look at them, made a pragmatic decision to support the initiatives, and the reaction of the other disgruntled employees was to basically label me as somebody who was sucking up to the boss, which was really not the case at all.
Jerry, thanks for that accusation of being a suck-up, Mark.
Yeah, I think that just turns on the sort of real ambiguities of this activity. It can be weaponized as a kind of a way of actually attacking people whom you don't like. I think it's perfectly possible that goes on, and I think it's very common to do that.
Jerry, thanks for the call. I'll go next to Randy on the line in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. I can't help wonder if some of this starts in, like, middle school or high school. But in myself, having been a foreman or supervisor, I've had people try to do that with me, which kind of left me feeling, like, not very respectful. You know, I didn't take advantage of it, but I've seen bosses that do. And, it's just kind of a nicky feeling, I guess.
I think that ickiness is just always a part of what's going on, and that accounts for, I think, a lot of the names. A lot of these coinages are just brilliant in the way that they sound good, and they're very vivid in terms of the images. We really do want to sort of know more about when someone is doing this, what their purpose is, and we give it this kind of a violent name in order to sort of make that as clear as possible.
Randy, thanks a lot for calling in. We're talking to Mark Parker, co-author of the new book, Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. You can join in with your thoughts, questions, experiences at 800-642-1234. We go next to Mark on the line in Racine. Mark, hi.
Hi. You were talking about weaponizing. It can also be used in comedy. One thing that comes to mind, I don't know if the author had seen it at all, Monty Python had a famous skit about sucking up and Yes Men.
The Hollywood producer one, is that it?
Well, there's one where the CEO is sitting around a table, and he starts to tell his idea, and he only gets out a couple words. Like, he says, well, the first part of my idea is I see a tree. Uh-huh. And one guy stands up and goes, a tree, I love it.
Brilliant, what a genius.
There are a lot of wonderful comic depictions. I mean, Smithers on The Simpsons is just wonderful because he really is a character with one sort of attribute, and yet it gives the writers this chance to sort of just go through all of the many possibilities for someone sucking up. I mean, there's one episode where he thinks the company is going to be sold to Germans, and so he has a book called How to Suck Up in German.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. I do remember that skit. I may have to go back and watch it now. Thanks for your call at 800-642-1234. Mark, do you have people who come up and volunteer examples to you of sycophancy once they know what you're working on?
Oh, gosh, yes, because I think there is a real pleasure of just sort of getting rid of some of these feelings that we have about suck-ups and sucking up in telling these stories and sharing them with other people. And I have to say, one of the things that our book tries to do is to think about sucking up through literature primarily, because we kind of wanted to also make the point that literature is a very good way to get out of behavior like this that you really can't know from the outside. Because of the way in which literary works are structured, we get inside the mind of the sycophant. But boy, everybody, I think, everybody has a story.
Back to our callers. Keith is on the line in Green Bay. Keith, hi.
Hi. I think we saw a remarkable example of someone almost demanding sycophancy at one of President Trump's early cabinet meetings, where he went around the room and every one of his cabinet secretaries told how wonderful he was and how grateful they were to be working for him and how great a job. And it was like the biggest suck-up session I've ever seen.
That was remarkable. That was the June 12th cabinet meeting, and there were very few people who didn't go along. It was really striking to see what was happening then. We really didn't, when we started writing this book, we certainly hadn't thought of incidents like that. For the most part, sucking up seems to be everywhere on both sides of the political spectrum, but it was hidden in the past, but not recently. It seems to be very open and much more sort of the idea is to show it as brazenly as possible and perform it as shamelessly as possible.
Keith, thanks for that call. So, Mark, how do we start to cure ourselves as individuals and maybe as a society of sycophancy?
I think that this the persistence of all of the stories from so far back in so many different ways and so many brilliant configuration shows us that it's not something that we're going to cure. We can sort of, I think, fight against it. And I think one of the first steps is to think about the enablers, because I think the enabler is someone who is in a position of power who requires this. And that is a particularly difficult thing to sort of combat when someone in power is actually requiring it. We can start there by thinking, when perhaps we're looking for people to work to hire, are they the kind of person who wants to enable this kind of activity? And to think very hard about what that would do to the workplace if you have someone like that. The other thing is to think about what Plutarch said, is the worst flatterer is what he calls the flatterer within, the person within us who allows us to desire so deeply this kind of blandishment, this kind of sort of gratification. That needs to be eradicated, and with that will come, I think, more mindfulness.
And on a related note, what are you hoping our listeners take away from your brief consideration of sycophancy?
Well, that it's more pervasive than we think, and really worse than we think it is. We often think of it as just a kind of isolated thing, and that it doesn't have any sort of after effects. It's a transaction. But in fact, it really does sort of lower the quality of the world in which we move, in which we have to work with others. If a place that is really sycophantic ceases to be a place where you can really see what someone is saying. You cannot be frank, really, in an environment like that. Everyone will say everything that you say is sort of a way of getting something or getting someone to think about something in a certain way. It becomes a completely manipulative environment, and there is a real cost to this.
We'll leave it there. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
It was glad to be here.
That's Mark Parker. He's a professor of English at James Madison University. He's co-author with Deborah Parker of the new book we've been talking about. It's called Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. Still time for you to share your experiences and your thoughts. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org, tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR, or you can post your stories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You're smart. You're clever. I know you are. So you'll have some great stories to share, I'm sure. If you are of a certain age, you may have played a computer game called Oregon Trail, the original or a remake. There have been a lot of versions over the years, but the gist, you play a settler on the Oregon Trail in the 1800s, and if you play it like I did, you die of snake bite or dysentery or something else bad. And now the modern-day state of Oregon has released a modern-day version of the game. It's called Travel Oregon. It's their tourism department that did this. At the beginning, you stock up on necessities like snow chains for your tires if you're headed out for a wilderness adventure, or artisanal coffee and kombucha if you're in the mood for some Portland wandering. Plus, you can buy dry socks. They're an option, and that's good. Because people, I haven't played the game. I don't get to play computer games on work time. People who have played the game, though, report that you can die of things like wet socks, and you can get yelled at for trying to pump your own gas at the gas station, which I recently learned traveling you can't do. It's illegal in Oregon. Maybe I'll play it at home. I don't know. I was thinking there's a clear Wisconsin analog to this. The town of Oregon, Wisconsin, could have Oregon Trail. I don't know how they'd run with it, but I'm sure they can come up with something. So I'm looking forward to playing Oregon Trail sometime soon. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.